So first of all, a survey about some of the stuff that's happening. You may have picked this up, Daily Mail, but it's true, okay? Female Dutch doctor drugged a patient's coffee, then asked her family to hold her down as she fought not to be killed, but to not break the country's euthanasia laws. Now, euthanasia is legal in the Netherlands, but only for people who are mentally competent. This woman had dementia. She had expressed some kind of wish earlier that if this happened, she might want to die. So they decided that she should. And because she struggled, she was held down by her family. There was another case where, this is actually a case where the lethal injection was given to end her life. So most people would feel slightly uncomfortable about that. Belgium authorised euthanasia of a terminally ill 9 and 11-year-old in the youngest cases worldwide. So again, Belgium has legalised euthanasia for adults. It's now extended that to children. So we are seeing the first cases coming through. One of the most recent countries to change the law is Canada. Thousands of euthanasia killings in Canada. It has one of the most radical laws on the planet around euthanasia at the moment. And there's a court case going on there where a man who was disabled and wanted care at home so that he could carry on at home was told that the state couldn't afford the care, but that they could offer him euthanasia. And so he started a court case about that. The state of Oregon in the US is one country that has legalized assisted suicide, where doctors, people can have help to end their lives. And the pattern you see here of increasing numbers every year is what we see in any jurisdiction that has. And so one of the main messages I'm going to give you here is that you cannot control it once you legalize it for any category of people at all. And what we're seeing in the UK is that after 12 years, really going back to 2006, and a dozen attempts to change the law through British parliaments to allow assisted suicide or euthanasia or both, all of those attempts have failed, but the lobby who want to bring this in are now moving to other areas, and they're going for three basic areas, and that's the pattern that we're seeing today. The first is that they're going for the small islands. So we've had a massive battle in Guernsey this year with an attempt to legalise assisted suicide, which failed by 24 votes to 12 in the final equation, and we were all, many of us are involved in there, going over there, speaking and so on, and supporting the people who were standing against it. Small islands. The second avenue is the courts. So if you fail through the parliament, then you bring cases to court. And the most recent case is the case involving this man, Noel Conway, who has a condition called motor neurone disease, where his nerves are gradually not functioning, so that he's losing the ability to move and breathe and so on. And he will eventually die from this disease. The average life expectancy is about 18 months. But he wants to change the law so that people can come before a high court judge, and if they are terminally ill adults with less than 6 months to live and they're mentally competent, then they can have helped to kill themselves. And Cannot Killing opposed this case in court. We intervened in it at the Court of Appeal, and thankfully we won. He has since gone back to the Court of Appeal to ask to appeal to the Supreme Court. They said no, so he's now gone directly to the Supreme Court to appeal, and we're waiting on that decision. But this is the latest of many cases that's been through the British court. So small islands, courts, and then the third avenue is what we call euthanasia by stealth. Now, let me illustrate that by saying that in the Netherlands, where assisted suicide and euthanasia are legal, there are five ways that you can kill people. And the Dutch are very transparent and honest and upfront, and they record everything diligently. And so we know exactly what's happening in the Netherlands. And the five ways are euthanasia, where the patient receives a lethal injection. Assisted suicide, where the doctor helps the patient to kill themselves by drinking poison effectively. And the other three ways in the Netherlands are, firstly, deliberate morphine overdose. So that's when you're giving morphine not to relieve pain, but actually with the intention of ending the patient's life. Fourth, the withdrawal of food and fluids in a patient who lacks mental capacity, so that they effectively dehydrated and to death. And then the fifth way is what they call terminal sedation, whereby you give people a massive dose of sedative to effectively render them unconscious, and then they will die over a period of a couple of weeks from dehydration. So there's five ways, if you like, that the Dutch do it. Now, in the UK, at the moment, supposedly all those five routes are closed. But as well as the small islands and the courts to legalise assisted suicide and euthanasia, there is a push to legalise euthanasia by stealth by these other routes. And it was a landmark case over the summer. If you were taking a holiday, you would have missed it. But it involved a man who went to the Supreme Court by the name, we don't know his real name, but he's known as Y, the Y case, the letter Y. And this is a man who had a heart attack. His heart stopped. They tried to resuscitate him. He suffered hypoxic brain damage, which means he wasn't getting enough oxygen to his brain. And he ended up in a condition known as the minimally conscious state, where he was awake, but only partially or intermittently aware. So his brain damaged. And now, patients in this condition, ever since a historic court ruling back in 1993 involving a man called Tony Bland, who was the 96th victim of the Hillsborough disaster, ever since the Bland case, anyone with minimally conscious state or persistent or permanent vegetative state, which Bland had, before they can have a feeding tube removed, they've got to go to the Court of Protection to get a ruling to do it. And as a result, in the last 25 years since Bland, only about 100 people have been taken to the Court of Protection and had tubes removed. Now, what this Supreme Court ruling did was that it removed the need to go to the court. So in other words, if doctors and relatives agree that it's in the patient's best interests, then they can have feeding tubes removed and be effectively dehydrated and sedated to death. Now, with patients with PVS or MCS, permanent vegetative state, minimally conscious state, we're not talking here about people who are imminently dying or terminally ill. These are brain damaged people who may live for years or even decades. But as a result of this court ruling now, the doctors and relatives agree they can have their food and fluid stopped. So small islands, courts, euthanasia by stealth, that's the three methods, if you like. And the Falklands, you may have missed this as well, the Falkland Islands have become the first British territory to vote in support of assisted dying. This happened just over the summer. I think it was 4-3. The law hasn't changed there yet. There's only 3,000 people on the island, so you wonder why they're doing it anyway. But if the law does change in Britain, then this law will come into act in Falkland Islands. So that's where we're at. And then the latest thing, this is part of what I was talking to Tim about over lunch. This was a Daily Mail story. Doctors could be allowed to end the lives of patients with dementia or other degenerative diseases if they can't feed themselves, as one brand's medics proposal is the most chilling thing she's ever heard. Now, the story behind this is that the British Medical Association, which is the doctors' trade union, who were very active in the Y case at the Supreme Court and giving all the expert evidence which swayed the Supreme Court judges in that case, the British Medical Association has just issued draft guidance on the removal of what they call clinically assisted nutrition and hydration. So that means feeding tubes either through the nose or into the stomach for people who, for whatever reason, are unable to feed themselves. And this guidance has not been seen widely. Most doctors don't even know about it. But the plan is to issue definitive guidance in October this year in conjunction with the General Medical Council. And in effect, what this is saying is that there are three groups of patients. Very simply, if you like, they are patients with persistent disorders of consciousness, so that's PVS or MCS that we've talked about already, people with degenerative conditions like dementia, or people who've got neurological deficits as a result of complex medical problems. So read for that, most of those people will have strokes. So people who have lost mental capacity and are brain damaged as a result of dementia, stroke, or persistent disorders of consciousness, as a result of this guidance, could have feeding tubes removed and effectively be dehydrated and sedated to death, even though many of them may live for many months, years, or even decades. So that's what we call euthanasia by stealth, and that involves the three other forms, ways of ending people's lives in the Netherlands. You may also be aware that of what's been happening in Gosport Memorial Hospital on the south coast, is that there's been an uncovering of the fact that 450 patients had their lives ended through doctors, largely one doctor, giving a massive overdose of morphine with the intention of ending their lives. And many of these patients were post-operative after hip replacements or surgery for broken hips and the like. And most of them were not imminently dying, not have terminal diseases, and many of them were not in pain either. So the morphine was given to end their lives through a syringe driver, 450 people. And there's been a huge outcry from the relatives of these patients involved, but there's been no proper police investigation or prosecution of what I would call euthanasia by stealth. So there's the background of what's been happening just in the last 6 months, really, in this country. Now, what are the arguments for euthanasia? Well, I think they're best personified by people, and you'll be surprised at some of the spokespeople here. But Tony Nicholson was a man with a condition called locked-in syndrome, where he was able to signal only with his eye movement what he wanted, but his brain was still fully intact. He wanted assisted suicide. He went to court, and he was denied that, and he died of natural causes. So this is what he said: I should be able to decide how and when I end my life. So personal choice or autonomy. George Carey, some of you will remember as the Archbishop of the Church of England, now an ardent spokesperson in favour of euthanasia. Well, the current law fails to address the question of why we should have forced terminally ill patients to go on in unbearable pain. Another churchman, Desmond Tutu, Tutu is now an advocate for euthanasia. We think largely because of his friendship with Nelson Mandela and the fact that Mandela was kept alive for a long period, quite arguably inappropriately, but he's gone much further than that and is now favouring euthanasia. And then some of you will recognise the name Baroness Mary Warnock if you've been interested in beginning of life issues, because she was the chairman of the Warnock Committee, which led to the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act. And this is what she says: if you're demented, you're wasting people's lives, your family's lives, and you're wasting the resources of the National Health Service. So that's an economic argument from Baroness Warnock. So those are some of the arguments. What's happening internationally? Well, I've alluded to this already, but there are three countries where there have been multiple attempts to change the law again and again and again and again and again, and that's the UK, the US, and Australia. There are countries and jurisdictions which have changed the law. Canada, the Netherlands, Belgium, we've mentioned already, and Luxembourg are examples. Which have legalised both assisted suicide and euthanasia. And there are countries which have, or at least states in the US, which have legalised just assisted suicide. So it's now, I think, six of the 50 states have done that, and I've listed them there. Oregon was the first, and there's other places where the battle is just beginning. In any debate, we have to be very careful to define our terms, and euthanasia is where someone intentionally kills, ends the life of a person whose life is felt not to be worth living. And it can be voluntary, in which case the person's asked for it. It can be non-voluntary, in which case they're not capable of asking for it because they're mentally incapacitated, but you do it anyway. Or it can be involuntary, where they are capable of asking for it, but you, and they don't want it, but you decide it's in their best interest and do it anyway. So that's euthanasia. And assisted suicide is where someone, it might be a doctor, might be someone else, helps someone to end their own life. So in both cases, the intention is the same, that the patient will die, but the final agent is different, whether it's a doctor or the patient themselves. And the reason it's important to separate these is not because they are morally or ethically different, because I think they're morally and ethically equivalent. But the reason it's important to understand the difference is because the British legal system treats them very differently in law. And for assisted suicide, it's the Suicide Act. So it's illegal to encourage or assist another person's suicide. You can go to prison for up to 14 years for that, although there are very few convictions. But when it's euthanasia, it's treated under the murder law, which is part of common law, court-made law, and it's a crime intentionally to take the life of another person, even for compassionate motives. And that's a mandatory life sentence. Now, in practice, that means 15 years, usually at least. So there are two different laws. And the other important thing to understand about these laws is that under British system, discretion is given both in prosecuting, so when the Crown Prosecution Service brings a case, they won't bring every case to court. They apply various criteria to decide to. And then there's also discretion in sentencing, in the sense that they make the punishment fit the crime. So you see that with murder. So with Stephen Marshall, under the murder law, where euthanasia is treated, Stephen Marshall came from county of Hertfordshire, okay? And he was involved in an event called the Jigsaw Murder, where he and someone else killed someone, cut their body up into different parts and distributed the body parts to various parts of the county. And this was, it was a hugely heinous crime. And he got 36 years, you see. Whereas Frances Inglis, on the other hand, she had a brain-damaged son who she was determined to end his life because she felt it wasn't worth living, and she cut off his oxygen supply, and that was judged to be murder, but she only got 9 years. And so there's discretion that can be applied. Kay Gilderdale was a woman who helped her daughter end her own life with an overdose of morphine, and she got a 12-month conditional discharge, which meant she didn't go to prison at all, but you know, there were certain restrictions on what she was able to do. So that's the thing to grasp, is that there are two different laws in Britain, the murder law and the Suicide Act, and in both of them there is an element of discretion that judges can apply. Now, just as when we consider what euthanasia is, we need to think about what it is not. And there's a huge amount of confusion about this. And if you just grasp the message of this slide here, then you will be able to resolve a lot of that confusion that people have, particularly in churches, about this issue. And I've got 3 points here. So firstly, stopping or not starting a medically useless treatment is not euthanasia. Now, for example, if someone has terminal cancer, which has spread to all their organs, and it's not going to be helped by radiotherapy or surgery or anything, and you give them chemotherapy, which is not going to extend their life but will make them feel a lot worse as they die, then it's actually good medical treatment to withhold the treatment in that case. But the point is that what they're dying from here is the underlying disease. That's very important, not anything that you have done. Secondly, pain relief when the intention is to kill the pain but not the patient. Now, if a person has severe pain and you give them a strong drug like morphine, then in good hands, the therapeutic dose, which will substantially ease the pain, is always going to be less than the lethal dose, which will kill the patient. Okay, but in very rare circumstances, close to death, it may be that in giving the morphine to relieve the pain, that you might shorten the patient's life. But the key thing is, what is the doctor's intention? Is the intention to relieve the pain, or is the intention to kill the patient? And that's what we call double effect, when you may foresee the patient's death, but your intention is to relieve the pain, and that's perfectly legal, and it's not euthanasia. It's another thing altogether to give a deliberate morphine overdose with the intention of killing the patient, which is what they did in Gosport. And then thirdly, if a competent patient, so someone who can make decisions for themselves, decides they don't want treatment for whatever condition, and they die from that condition as a result of not having that treatment, that's not euthanasia. In fact, you know, if you stepped in and treated them against their will, you could be held up for assault. Now, the reason it's important to grasp these things is that people in the pro-euthanasia lobby will say, oh, we're doing it anyway in these ways, and the point is that we're not. So, just moving on, I said there have been 12 attempts through British parliaments in 12 years to change the law. They've all failed. These are the last three that we've had, and the Maris Bill in September 2015 was defeated by an overwhelming majority of 330 votes to 118, the 212 majority. And it was the biggest defeat that any euthanasia bill has had in Britain. Now, why is this? Well, in fact, when you look at how the parties voted, every single party voted against it, with the exception of the Greens, who were 1-0 in favour. So both Tory and Labour were equally opposed. Why did they vote so strongly against it? Because they were convinced right across the House that a change in the law to allow euthanasia could be abused and vulnerable people could be exploited. So it was about issues of public safety, not necessarily that they believed that ending the lives of people was always morally wrong, but because of the repercussions for the safety of vulnerable patients. And what we've seen with these bills is that as time goes on, they become more and more and more restricted because the pro-euthanasia lobby think, well, you know, if it's only for adults who are terminally ill and mentally competent, then surely that's okay. And so they become more and more restricted in what they're going to get in order that they can establish the principle. But in fact, the defeats have been bigger and bigger for them because people see the public safety issues. Faulkner's and Maris's bills were very, very similar. So there's a bit of background. We've seen a dozen attempts through various British parliaments to change the law. They've all failed. So they're going for the three other avenues, the small islands, court cases, and euthanasia by stealth. That's the pattern. And these are the challenges that we've had this year, most of which I've mentioned already. What's coming up in the future? This is what we expect in the next 12 months. There's going to be, we think that Noel Conway may get permission to go to the Supreme Court, and if so, we'll see another court case. And then there are three other parliaments, the Isle of Man and Jersey. There are noises on both these islands about changing the law, and we're expecting to see another attempt in Scotland too in the next 12 months. So I hope the picture you get here is that there is overwhelming, relentless pressure going on and on and on to change the law in Britain. Now, why is that? Well, the answer is very simple. There's an extremely well-resourced and well-organised lobby who are pushing for this and keep bringing it back into court. And this is why it's happening in Britain and not so much in other countries. So let's look at some of the reasons why euthanasia is not a good idea from a purely practical point of view, and then we'll come back to and look at what the Bible says as we finish off. I'll just give you four reasons here. But first of all, vulnerable people will feel pressure. If you make it legal to end your life through euthanasia and assisted suicide, then there will be people who feel that they are a burden on others and that they should end their lives so as not to accentuate that burden. And the bottom line is, if you like, that the duty, the right to die can so easily become the duty to die. It's not only people who are sick that feel pressure, who are old or elderly or demented or whatever, depressed, but also carers and relatives and health professionals can feel pressure and be coerced. So the law in its current state protects people from being either coerced into assisted suicide or euthanasia, or coerced into helping people to kill themselves. And that's been the main reason. Second reason, incremental extension is inevitable. Now, you'll hear people talking about the slippery slope. I never use that term, because I use the term incremental extension, because slippery slope is all about passively slipping down the slope. That's not actually what's happening here. What we have is a group of activists who are actively pushing the envelope and trying for incremental extension. And they know if they get the foot in the door for one category of people, then they can crank it up using human rights legislation by saying, well, you know, why are these people having it and these people can't? It's not fair, okay? So that's the technique. And the problem with this is that the two main arguments which are used, you've heard them already, autonomy, it's my right, and compassion, you know, this is the kind thing to do, they apply very widely. And so when you get a group saying, well, it's only for mentally competent adults with 6 months or less to live, but they're using the arguments of autonomy and compassion, you know that once that is in place, they're going to say, well, here's a person just outside the boundaries. Surely compassion, or, you know, they're old enough to decide, and so on. And so the minute you surrender the principle, you are in a place of incremental extension where it will be cramped up. And we've seen that very clearly with abortion. If you were here this morning, you'll know that we have a law which is supposedly quite restrictive, but actually in effect we have abortion on request. And this is what we see in every jurisdiction that legalizes assisted suicide and euthanasia. We see incremental extension. So you start with the terminally ill, then it's the chronically ill. You start with adults, then it's children. You start with the mentally competent, and then it's mentally incompetent. Oh, you know, he can't say, but he would have wanted it. He wouldn't have wanted to live this way. Oh, and by the way, there is quite a large inheritance and we're spending it on care, you see. And so Parliament hasn't so far been convinced that the proposed safeguards are actually safe, that they're really just, in a sense, entry criteria, and they're not safeguards at all. And there are problems with all of these things, and particularly from people who might have a vested interest in the death of another person, either for emotional or financial reasons. You know, where there's a will, there's an anxious relative. Think about that. And this is why we see the numbers going up. And Belgium, I mentioned already, but in Belgium, only doctors can carry out euthanasia, and yet 50% of euthanasia nurses have killed. Only mentally competent people can have it, but 50% of euthanasia nurses have killed without consent. One third of cases are voluntary, 50% of cases unreported. Euthanasia patients are now used as organ donors. They call it organ transplant euthanasia. It's now passed for minors, and there have been cases very distressing of people being blind or mentally ill or whatever. And you know, the point is, they go far beyond the law, but there's no prosecution. Sorry, yeah. They're all in peer-reviewed journals. So number one, vulnerable people will feel pressure. Number two, you can't control it because of incremental extension. Number three, there's a better way. It's called palliative care. And this is Baroness Laura Finlay with her mum, who was dying and has since died. And Laura Finlay is a member of the House of Lords. That's why she's called Baroness. She's also a professor in palliative medicine, specializing in looking after dying people. And, you know, mum wanted to die, but convincing her to live gave us both a gift beyond measure. So the point is that many people fear the dying process, but it tends to be the fear primarily of the worried well when people experience what good care can offer and how their pain and other distressing symptoms can be relieved. They change their minds, and very, very few people who are dying actually want euthanasia. Now, you might not have that impression, but because the few that do tend to be the ones who shout loudest on the television and bring court cases. But even if you take motor neurone disease, we're seeing, you know, 5,000 people in the country who have it, life expectancy 18 months, 1,000 of them die every year, but it's only a very small number who you ever see wanting a change in the law, even with things like motor neurone disease. And that's because symptoms can be relieved or substantially alleviated. And colleagues of mine who worked in palliative medicine, Rob George, who's at the moment the president of the Association for Palliative Medicine and worked for many decades in palliative care, says he could count on the fingers of both hands the number of people who've actually had ongoing requests for euthanasia in the last 20,000 patients he's looked after. So it's incredibly rare. You treat people properly, almost overwhelmingly they don't want it. And it's much more than about the person than the disease. So you can have two people with the same condition, one wants it, one doesn't. Why is that? It's not so much because of the symptoms, because the real reasons that people give for wanting euthanasia have nothing to do with pain or other distressing symptoms at all. It's about these sorts of things. So in Oregon, this comes out, there's an annual report every year from Oregon about the reasons why people do it. You can see decreasing enjoyment of life, loss of autonomy, loss of dignity. Now these are what we call existential symptoms. They're not medical symptoms. They're much more spiritual problems. They have to do with meaning and value and that kind of thing. I remember meeting a guy called Matt Hampson, who you might have heard of. He was a rugby player, was in the under-19 England team, broke his neck in a scrum collapse, ended up in a wheelchair and on a ventilator. And he has a ministry. He's not a Christian, actually, but he's a motivational speaker. He goes around schools and talks about the meaning of life. Mm. Despite being on a ventilator and paralysed from the neck down. And yet there was another man with the same injury who went off to Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland to kill himself. And I remember I was on a TV programme with Matt and we were talking about this, and he said, you know, I tried to get through to this guy, help him to see meaning and purpose in life, and I just couldn't get through. So the point is, it's much more about the patient than the person than it is about the illness, and people will react to whether it's cancer or motor neurone disease or injury or whatever in very different ways. But my argument is that we shouldn't be giving lethal injections for what really are in essence spiritual problems. And then the final reason, the current law works actually quite well, because the current law, on the one hand, it's got a very stern face. It provides a powerful deterrent because of the penalties that it holds in reserve. You know, you cross this line, you might go to prison. Makes people think twice. But on the other hand, it gives discretion in sentencing and prosecuting. So it's got a kind heart, you see. So that not everybody ends up before the courts. There's a stern face and a kind heart. And we've always argued that that's the best kind of law, with a ban on all assisted suicide and euthanasia, but with discretion given in hard cases, and that law doesn't need changing. The minute you start to create exceptions in it, then you are at the same time removing legal protection from a certain group of vulnerable people. So there's the reason. Now, let me just step back and look at something a little bit more chilling. What's that?
Auschwitz.
Who's been there to Auschwitz? Okay, some of you have well worth going, but who are these people? Well, the doctors at Nuremberg. Okay, there are 23 of them, doctors and scientists. The clue is in the... these people were doctors who were involved in the Holocaust. And the Holocaust would never have happened if it wasn't for the medical profession. Because actually what began in... what began or what ended in places like Auschwitz actually began in hospitals. And it began initially in pediatric hospitals. So the first thing they did was to kill 5,000 children who were disabled. Then the next thing they did was to kill 60,000 adults who were either elderly or had mental health problems. Now, the reason they did that was they needed 60,000 beds because people had had their houses bombed or they were coming back from abroad, expatriate Germans, or they'd been injured in the war. And so they calculated, we need 60,000, how are we going to do it? We'll clean out these hospitals. They contacted the relatives when they could see there wasn't going to be a problem. They euthanized these folk. And then it gradually spread from there. So the same doctors were deployed to the camps, doctors, nurses, and other medical people. It would never have started with that. And many of those who were involved claimed that they got involved for purely compassionate reasons, but it did something to their consciences so that at the end they were doing, they were throwing living children into the fires at Auschwitz. Now, what I'm saying to you is that I think we are potentially on the verge of another Holocaust if we're not careful about this. And there are four reasons for that. Number one, we've talked about already this morning, is the demographic time bomb in the West. So, you know, this is Japan. The age population used to look like that in 1950, with 35% younger than 15 and only 5% over 65. But now we are in this situation. Some of it's due to people living longer. A lot of it is due to fall in the birth rate and abortion. And the situation is, the danger here is that the generation that killed its children through abortion is at risk of being killed by its children through euthanasia. Why? Well, this is part of the reason, the international debt crisis and the problems in the NHS we have are largely because of underfunding for the need that's required. That's all related to the debt of the British government. And if you look at, this is just the US, it's gone up further under Trump, but every country virtually is now in debt, and that debt is growing, and that is a really serious situation because more and more money goes on debt service and less is available for healthcare and so on. So debt crisis, demographic change. I think this is another big reason, the breakdown of Western society, so that there are not the same supports there through families. Families are spread out and broken up much more. And then finally, the advance of atheism. So the belief system, but also with it, the ethics of secular humanism, which do not see any problem with actively ending people's lives. And I think these getting more and more into the corridors of power and the mountains of culture and influencing the trajectory that our culture and society is taking. So I think that euthanasia and assisted suicide will probably be the final skittles to fall in Western civilization after all the other changes that we've already seen. That's more on that. So what about the Bible? Okay. Now, you can't look up euthanasia in a concordance or on Bible Gateway, but there are two cases of euthanasia in the Bible, interestingly enough. Abimelech, who was one of the judges, or they called him the anti-judge, because he was a fairly reckless character, but he was storming a tower. A woman threw a millstone off it, hit him on the head, and as he lay dying from his head injury, he said, "Please kill me so that it can't be said that a woman killed Abimelech." And you might say that's death with dignity. Okay. And then there was Saul, who at the final stage of his life suffered from a penetrating abdominal injury. He was stabbed, and there were several accounts of his death, but in one of them, he allegedly asked an Amalekite to put him out of his misery. You might say that was compassion. And there's not a comment on these, but it's interesting that there are two cases of euthanasia in the Bible. But we mustn't go to narratives and individual cases, although it was quite interesting that when this Amalekite came to David and confessed that he had finished Saul off, David's reaction was to order the Amalekite's death. So he saw it as not just killing the Lord's anointed, but actually crossing a moral boundary as well. So we're looking then at principles in Scripture, and we start with this principle that human beings are made in the image of God, and that's why we are so precious in his sight. So here's Michelangelo's picture of the creation that you can see in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And this rather quaint-looking gentleman here is Thomas Sydenham, who was a 16th century or 17th century Puritan in Britain and regarded as the British Hippocrates or the father of medicine in Britain. And Sydenham used to say to his students that human beings were incredibly precious for two reasons. Firstly, that every single human being, regardless of its age, race, sex, degree of disability, disease, or whatever, is precious because every human being is made in the image of God. And he said the second reason why human beings are precious is because God gave nobility to the human race by becoming a human being and taking humanity into himself in the person of Christ. Sydenham said a lot of other things as well. But that's where we start, that human beings are incredibly precious. Secondly, because of the fall of human beings are also capable of great evil. And so it shouldn't surprise us, a Holocaust should not surprise us. What should surprise us is that it doesn't happen more frequently, more often, in more places. But we should not be surprised by people pushing the boundaries and doing wrong things with an increasing rates. And this is why laws are needed to protect the innocent. And the fundamental role of the government is to protect its weakest members of the society from abuse and exploitation. That's why we have laws. And then, of course, we have the basis of morality in the Bible and the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. And as Ashton reminded us this morning, that means taking the life of an innocent human being. It's universally forbidden in Scripture, all the way through. There were cases where the lives of guilty human beings could be taken under Old Testament law in the case of self-defense or just war or for various capital offenses and so on. But all the way through Scripture, intentional killing of innocent, legally innocent human beings is universally wrong. And that's based Genesis 9:6 on the very idea there that every human being is made in the image of God, and that's wrong. That's why it's wrong to take the life, because we belong to God, not to ourselves. Even our own lives are not our own, they belong to God. And so the doctrine of the sanctity of life is based on these principles that we're made in God's image, that taking innocent human life is wrong, that only guilty life can be taken in various circumstances. And when you see the sixth commandment, you shall not kill, expounded, this is what you see, that its fundamental reason is. Nextly, the rule of law, that because human beings are capable of great evil, we need laws to protect the innocent and we need governments to frame them. And so the Lord appoints governments and raises up rulers with the aim that they will frame laws which protect people from exploitation and abuse. Seeing things through the eyes of faith and understanding suffering from faith's perspective. You know, suffering is not the greatest evil in the world, and it's not the worst thing that can happen to someone. In fact, if you give someone a lethal injection in order to relieve their suffering, or at least eliminate their life, then you could be doing them the greatest disservice possible, because you're propelling them forward to a judgment for which they might not be prepared. There's nothing less compassionate in the whole world than doing that. And we need to see life through the eyes of faith. This guy here is a Church of England vicar. He's also, my name's Michael Wenham. He wrote this book called My Donkey Body, because he also has motor neurone disease. It's a slow developing one, and has been one of our most effective spokesmen on this issue. But, you know, helping to see that the Lord is with us in our suffering, and that suffering is not the worst thing that happens, but that God can use it for all sorts of good purposes. And then there's the thing of hope. Shawshank Redemption, most popular film in Britain, if you've seen it. But read the strapline in that. Hope is a good thing, maybe the best thing. And a good thing never dies. And this is what sustains this guy through a long imprisonment. And I mentioned Matt Hampson earlier, the rugby player who had the... And as I say, he's not a Christian believer, but he expresses a huge amount of hope about the future. And when you hear him talking about his life, you know, it makes you feel... You wonder why you ever complained about anything in your life. Mm. I don't think, he says, I don't think about what I can't do. I think about what I can do. I can see. I can hear. I can still talk. I can smell a steak cooking on a barbecue and eat it. Yeah. And when I sleep, I dream. And when I dream, I can still play rugby. It's all about the perspective that people... Brilliant. Of course, we have the eternal perspective of where, as well as looking beyond death to that hope. And then, love. I think it's a huge misunderstanding about what love is. Love is not about giving people what they want. Any parent knows that. It's not about affirming people in their choices. It's about doing the very best for people. And this lady, who is a Christian believer, she's now with the Lord, Alison Davis, and she has a whole host of medical conditions, spina bifida and bladder problems, recurrent infections and so on. Spent life in a wheelchair, was deeply depressed and suicidal. And a man, Colin Hart, who became her best friend and her carer, came alongside her and helped her through the situation. And Colin showed her what I would call tough love. And you know what tough love does? Tough love sits in her wheelchair at night beside her bed to stop her getting into it and going off to the bathroom to find the razor blades. Tough love says, even if you hate me for it, I'm not going to let you do this to yourself. Because you're better than that, and you're precious in God's sight. And I'm going to do what's best for you. That's what real love, tough love is. That's the love that took Jesus Christ to the cross and made him bear that suffering for us. It's not about affirming people's choices and giving them what they want when it is something wrong or not good for them. So there you are. There's some principles. And I think... let me just close on this slide, because I think that there are problems that Christians get into in thinking about these issues, and there's a lot of confusion in the church about this issue. And I have to say to you, of all the issues in which we're involved in, Andrea might say this as well, but you know, there are certain things where you have a lot of people on your side and rooting for you. You know, when you're standing up for civil liberties and the freedom to preach the gospel, or freedom of conscience, same-sex marriage, even abortion. But this is one of the loneliest of all issues. And when you stand up and speak on this, you find that you are often in a minority of one. And you can even feel that you're running into the machine gun fire and there are people shooting you in the back from the trenches who aren't prepared to put their heads above the parapet on this issue. And there's a huge amount of confusion in the churches. So let me just say, I think these are some of the big theological confusions. The first one is situation ethics. This is Joseph Fletcher's idea that all that matters is love, and you can cross and break moral laws so long as you're acting in love. Completely unbiblical, because love takes us beyond the moral law to the very spirit that underlies it. You know, so not only must we not kill but not hate, not only do we not commit adultery but we don't lust, and so on. But it doesn't, in so doing, make the moral law of not killing innocent human beings null and void. Cheap grace. Now, we're not under law, but we're under grace, so we can do what we like. It doesn't really matter. Well, I'm afraid that the evidence of real faith is a changed moral life, and that grace gives us the power through the Holy Spirit to live those changed moral lives, not to compromise on it. Other people say, you know, ethics, well, you know, euthanasia, it's a secondary issue. Christians can disagree about it. You know, Romans 14, weaker brother and all that kind of stuff. But I would argue that nowhere in Scripture do we see that in the category of what Paul called a disputable matter over which Christians can disagree. It is in the same category as sex outside marriage. And just read 1 Corinthians 6 or the end of Romans 13 to know about what the Bible says about that. And then the final thing, I call personal pietism. The world is not our problem, and we should not impose our morality. Well, I'd say to that no, Christians, we are in the world and not of the world, and we're to be engaged in it and not divorced from it, and that we are responsible for what happens in our country. And we will have to stand before the Lord on that final day and give account of how we lived our lives. And in a democracy, we are rulers, because we have a vote and we can influence public policy, and we have a responsibility. So it's not about not imposing our morality. It is really about not allowing others to impose their immorality on our society, but using the power and influence we have to ensure that the laws on the statute book in our country are just and fair and protect the innocent from harm and exploitation and abuse. And this is why this battle is so important to fight. And it depresses me when I hear people say, oh, you know, there's no point, just give up, and so on. And the reason it does is because actually the law could have changed back in 1992, at the Bland case.
Yeah.
We're now in 2018, it's 26 years later, and the law has still not changed. Of course, we've got all these other problems and challenges that I've talked about, of the small islands and the courts and euthanasia by stealth and so on. But it is a battle worth fighting. And even in a godless country like Britain, this is an issue. When people hear the arguments in Parliament, they get it. And they have consistently stopped a change in the law. And we must continue fighting this battle, not just here, but all around the world.